Hello, everybody. This is George Frangoulis. I'm the host of the Farmstead Radio Show. This is Belfast Community Radio, WBFY 100.9 FM, Belfast, Maine. We're here again in the studio, and we have another wonderful guest today, Mr. John Toomey. John is a back-to-the-lander farmsteader living in Montville, and he has come from spending 37 years in academe as a professor at the University of Massachusetts in Dartmouth. He retired in 2009, and he and his partner, Lee, have moved up to Montville. So today we're going to hear a lot about how you run a farm year-round. John has written and published a book called Retiring To, Not From. It's Pursuing a Simpler Life. And one of the tags on his book cover, which I'm going to read to you as a tease, is The Intimate Details of Life on a Remote Farm in Maine. So if that doesn't keep you on the edge of your seat, I don't know what will. But John's going to tell us all about his life living on his farm from when he started it. And so with no further ado, John, welcome to the show. We're glad to have you here. And can you tell us just a little bit about what brought you to the state of Maine to farm?
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here this evening. Once I finished graduate school and began teaching at UMass Dartmouth, I had a long interest in returning to a rural life. I'm from a rural background originally. And during the summers, the first few years I was teaching, I visited various parts of northern New England looking for a farm. The states of Vermont, New Hampshire, Western Mass, and even up into Quebec and Nova Scotia. I saw lots of places, but none that really struck my fancy or met my needs. And so I continued looking and found this place in Montville, and upon driving into the farmyard there, I knew that was the place. It had great old buildings, a large farmhouse, an attached barn. It was on the side of the mountain, Hogback Mountain, and the lay of the land was very much to my liking. It had a combination of roughly 40 acres of fields and 85 acres of woods, and I knew that I'd be able to spend a great deal of time, if not an entire lifetime, working on that land, improving it for my well-being, and most importantly, or perhaps more importantly, for the well-being of the wildlife that inhabited that property, that side of Hogback Mountain.
And you've been living there for the past, what, eight or nine years?
We retired in 2009, moved up full-time in 2009. And in between 2008 and 2009, I had a lot of work done on the old farmhouse. The builder, Jay Fisher from Coal Mountain Builders, handled the entire project. And really, Jay was a superb guide in that process. His aim was to bring the old place into the 21st century while at the same time maintaining the traditional lines, respecting all of the good stuff that the old farm had. And I think he did that in a spectacular way. In fact, the farm was originally owned by the Howard family, and they'd been there since the 1860s. And the house was built in 1864. And about a year and a half ago, I got in touch with the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of Lauren and Gertie Howard, who owned the farm, and invited them out. And they had been there when they were youngsters, so they remember the old place rather well. I was quite moved to find that they were very, very pleased by all of the changes, changes to the facade that had taken place. The improvements, the putting in of modern appliances and so on, electricity, plumbing, etc. But they were touched by the fact that it was it felt exactly the way it was when they were children. And to me, that was very important. And I can add to that that there have been a number of times during the summers, even before we moved up full-time, that old-timers who were friends of the Howards would come down the road, and they'd stop. Some of them were relatives of Lauren and Gertie Howards. And they'd stop and look across the fields, which I maintain rather meticulously, honestly, the way the Howards did. And they're stunned by the fact that they say, inevitably, the old place looks exactly the way it did when Lauren and Gertie were here. In fact, there was one relative from the Orono area who actually began to have tears in his eyes. He said, I can remember being out there haying with Lauren. And honest to God, John, you've kept the place looking exactly as it did then. Indeed, I had the great fortune of meeting Mrs. Howard, Gertie Howard, when she was about 95 or 96. And when I was introduced to her, it was quite touching. She looked up and she said, well, I'm glad to meet you, but we never really should have sold that place. And you could see that she was looking back on her many, many years at that farm and recalling those as probably the best years of her life. And I promised her at that point that I would keep the buildings maintained and intact. I'd shore up the barn and keep a roof on it and keep all of the buildings in good shape, and that I would keep the fields that they had cleared and kept open for so many years mowed and open. And I've been able to keep that promise, and with just a little bit of luck, I'll be able to keep that promise throughout my lifetime, and my plan is to keep that promise beyond my lifetime.
Well, that sounds great, John. You know, I did see the picture of your farm, the buildings. I think it was on the cover of your book, the book jacket. It's a magnificent looking place, and I want to hear more about that, about the projects that you had to undertake to get it where it is now, and also about the way you heat with solar. But before we get into that, let me just backtrack a little bit.
Sure.
So that our listeners can find out, get a little bit more information about who you were before you came to Maine. And I've read your bio on LinkedIn, and it said that you are an emeritus chancellor and professor from the University of Massachusetts in Dartmouth. You spent 37 years there as a professor. What did you teach? What was your discipline?
I taught Spanish, Portuguese, Latin American literature, and Spanish literature.
And
loved every moment of it.
And did any of that inform you or inspire you to become a Maine farmer?
Well, I would say honestly it was my childhood that inspired me to want to live on a farm. I lived in a very, very rural area of Connecticut and western Massachusetts. And I had very few neighbors, but the most important neighbor that I had was a man named Emerson Davis on the Greystone Farm. And I moved away from that area after having gotten to know him for about 11 years of my life and know his farm and so on and so forth. And I saw that Greystone Farm sold and subdivided into housing lots. And I moved to another town right next door to the town I was raised in originally. And when I first went there, it had, about 400 people, and I think it has around 6,000 now. So as a teenager, I witnessed the transformation of farms into building lots and farms into commercial property in that town and others in that area. So I always loved the rural life as a child. It was very important to me to spend time in nature. I spent literally all of my time in nature as a kid. We didn't have a great deal of money. I have 7 brothers and sisters and had a fairly humble childhood. And so my fun was had out in the woods and fishing and observing wildlife and observing birds. Also, simply building bird feeders and feeding birds and making piles of acorns for chipmunks and such were the way we entertained ourselves. So I longed to get back to that rural life. So that was a factor. As the twig, so to speak, is bent, so grows the tree, and that certainly is true in that regard. However, in addition to that, As I delved into Spanish and Latin American literature, there are a number of people who wrote in those areas who talk about solitude, who talk about tranquility of rural life, who talk about the wonder of a rural existence, who talk about the wonders of the way Native Americans relate to the land. And so that added, if you will, fuel to my fire to want to pursue a life that was in harmony with nature, a life in which I could provide a great deal of my own food, and a life in which I could do something to protect the wild creatures and the wild lands that were so very important to me in my formative years. And I've worked hard to do that out at the Howard Place. And so far, I'd say things are going along quite well.
Is that what you call your farm, the Howard Place, or does it have another name?
We call it the Howard Place out of respect for old Lauren Howard.
I see. Yeah. Now, you're not doing all this heavy lifting by yourself, are you?
Pretty essentially, yes.
You don't have any help?
Well, Lee and I do everything alone.
Who's Lee?
Yeah, Lee's my partner.
Okay.
And we've been out there together for 9 years, or 8 years now. And she loves that wildlife as well as I do. She's a fantastic gardener. She enjoys the wildlife every bit as much as I do. We work on habitat together. And what she doesn't work on per se, she enjoys seeing what I've done on it. And so there's a lot to do, of course. But sometimes people ask me, it sounds as if you're so busy you barely have time for anything else. We often say the maximum we work per day is probably 2 to 3 hours, depending on the season. There can be seasons like the summer, early summer, and in the fall when we're putting up food, when we'll put in more time. But basically, we always have lots of time to relax, and particularly the winter. We just love the winter. Do a lot of skiing and bird watching and tracking of wildlife and so on. So it's not exhausting. We know what we want to do. We know how to do it. We know when to do it. And most importantly, we D-O-I-T. We do it when we have to. And so we get things in pretty good shape.
So you D-O-I-T it and D-I-Y it, I suppose, as well. You do it yourself.
That's exactly right, yeah.
There you go. Well, when did you decide to take on this life? You've been teaching. You were teaching for a good number of years, over almost 4 decades.
Yeah. Well, I began teaching at UMass in 73, finished my graduate work in 72, and came right to UMass. And I was fortunate to get a job at a nice state university and taught wonderful, wonderful youngsters. It was a tremendously rewarding career. Really, in a way, you know, as a professor, you're nurturing young minds, you're nurturing the future generation, you're doing something good for the world. And that, to me, was very important and powerfully rewarding. To no small extent, working on a farm, you're doing something very similar. You're nurturing your plants, you're nurturing your trees, you're nurturing the habitat, which is so important to me. And in the process, you're nurturing the wild creatures that live there. So nurturing is a critical component. I think it's a profoundly satisfying type of activity for me. And in that regard, the teaching career of 37 years is very much in harmony with the nurturing that I'm doing now. I'm simply nurturing different kinds of things. They don't write papers. They don't take exams. And they don't answer questions.
Do you invite folks to work on your farm in the summertime, like the Nearings and Elliot Coleman did for a while?
No, we don't. We're pretty much introverts, to be quite honest with you. And we're quiet people. We like it very quiet. We like to see wildlife that's completely undisturbed. So as we move about the land, we move about peacefully and quietly. And if we come upon a coyote or a fox or a deer or a turkey or whatever, we just sort of keep walking. We behave in an unoffensive fashion. And the result is that we're able to move around these wild creatures and actually get relatively close to them. Lee has a couple that she actually speaks to as she walks by them, and they just sort of stand there and seem to have almost accepted her and us as fellow creatures who are unlikely to do them any harm. So we don't have anybody else come on to help us. We love people, but we're just very quiet, very peaceful, very, very, if you will, introverted folks who get a huge amount of pleasure out of just chatting with one another, having our meals together, reporting back what we've seen when we're out on a walk on the land, sharing our labors in the garden and the preservation of the food and the cutting of all of our firewood and the bringing in of all of our firewood and the emptying of our ash pans, et cetera, et cetera. We just stay at it together, and it's a incredibly peaceful and incredibly rewarding life.
Well, it sounds idyllic. Is the wintertime a favorite season of yours?
Actually, it is. Many times a relative, early on especially, will call up and in the winter, and they'll say with a sense of foreboding in their voice, well, how's that winter going up there? And we always say, geez, it's just great. One of the lovely factors is that we're both retired. And so we're not slugging down the road to go out to a job every day. And that does make a huge difference. We do have our both cars garaged, which also makes a hell of a difference in that we're not chipping ice off them whenever we do have to go out. However, we like the peace and quiet of the winter months. Both of us are pretty experienced cross-country skiers. We have wide backcountry cross-country skis. We have mountaineering snowshoes that we make trails with. And so we go out and we have 3 or 4 miles of trails through the woods and around the fields that we keep open all the time. And we'll go out 85 to 90 times during the course of the winter skiing. And when I say ski, we ski for an hour and a half at a shot. And so we really do enjoy that. There was one day I often tell people, we went out, we left the house, it was 10 below zero, and we got back, it was 18 below zero, and we were actually quite warm at the end of the whole experience. One of the great joys of the skiing is that you're going over snow, and you get to see who's been there the evening before. So we know the tracks of all of the animals, we know where they move and who's who in the area. And so we encounter the tracks of red fox, coyotes, occasionally a bobcat track, white-tailed deer, wild turkeys, partridge, fisher, mink, ermine, among a few others, mice and so on and so forth. Squirrels, obviously, appear from time to time. And then we also always bring along a pocket full of sunflower seeds. And Lee has worked hard to get to know several flocks of chickadees and rose-breasted nuthatches and white-breasted nuthatches. They don't run in flocks. It's just pairs. And so as we're skiing along, there are several places we'll stop, just hold out our hand with a handful of seeds, and a chickadee will land on there and a white rose-breasted nuthatch will land, eat right out of our hands. And now we have, the number of chickadees has actually increased in the last 8 years, so it's almost impossible not to go out and ski around and have several chickadees follow you. And you just stop, reach out your hand, and they'll eat out of your hand. Now, that might not seem like an earth-shattering experience to someone, but to a quiet person who enjoys nature and who enjoys nurturing, it's a very moving and thrilling experience.
Well,
and,
I can understand that.
Yeah, and it's one we seem not to tire of.
Oh, John, that's terrific. Let me just take a pause here for a minute so our listeners know that this is George Frangoulis with the Farmstead Radio Show at WBFY 100.9 FM in Belfast, Maine. And we're chatting this evening with Mr. John Toomey, who has a farm in Montville, Maine, and he's telling us about what it's like living in almost seclusion on this farm and enjoying the winter season. You talk a lot about wildlife. I can understand your passion for enjoying the winter season and enjoying wildlife. Just one quick little thing that I wanted to ask you earlier about your academic career. Where did you go to college?
I went to Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven, Connecticut, and I took my PhD at St. Louis University in St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay. Yeah. And do you miss the classroom?
You know, I actually don't. I loved the teaching. I actually was just thrilled by it every moment. I can honestly say I never went into a class thinking this is a job, and I never got to the end of a class thinking, oh, my God, I hope this ends in a hurry. Inevitably, I was just completely enthralled in what I was doing. So I enjoyed it thoroughly, but I took the position fairly early on, as soon as I acquired the farm out here, that I wanted to retire at an age that I would be able to have another life, have another existence, so that I'd be well enough and strong enough and able enough to actually really delve into a completely different lifestyle. Now, I stay in touch with my colleagues down at UMass via email all the time. I gave a talk down there on this book in October of last year. It was really a fun experience. But in all honesty, I've just moved right on and into this new lifestyle, and it seems to satisfy all my needs to nurture and accomplish things, make concrete progress on improving the fields and in beautifying the farmhouse and, frankly, beautifying the land. I almost view it like a work of art, really. There are numerous places where I work on brushy habitat or wood piles, brush piles, or apple trees. There are about 350 apple trees on it that I've trimmed up, oak trees I've planted. So as I walk around, my chainsaw is almost a paintbrush, and I beautify these areas, in my view, and make them more amenable to wildlife. My aim always with everything I do on the property is to make it more appealing to wildlife. I remove no organic matter from the farm at all. Since 1978, I haven't taken one stitch of organic matter off the farm. As I mow a field, I leave the hay there to mulch. When I cut trees, I leave the tops there to mulch back into the ground to improve the quality of the soil and to feed wildlife and to create habitat in terms of brush piles. And in the garden also, we use all organic matter right from the farm. In fact, I add hay to the garden every year, and the garden now is 12 to 18 inches higher than the land around it because of the addition of organic matter over the years since 1979, since I've had a garden there.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more specifically about your gardening practices. I read that you grow and preserve vegetables and fruits. Can you tell us a little bit about the kinds of things that specifically that you grow in terms of vegetables and fruits?
Sure, happily. We grow and preserve 100% of the fruits and vegetables that we eat. We buy a few bananas, and that's literally it. So we also have a very clear idea of how much produce we'll get from the number of plants. So in the book, I detail the number of specific plants of every type that we grow. So we grow potatoes, three kinds of potatoes, German butterballs and magic mollies and French fingerlings. We grow rhubarb. We grow butternut squash. Six plants of butternut squash last year yielded 55 butternut squash, which weighed 254 pounds. We literally weighed them all. And so we're still working our way through that incredible
crop. Are those
the
squash in the tractor that I saw in the picture?
They are, exactly, yes, yes. We grow all of our own garlic, onions, parsnip, carrots, beets, turnip, purple cauliflower, white cauliflower, green cauliflower, broccoli, kale, Swiss chard, arugula, celery, parsley. Let's see what else. We grew sweet potatoes successfully for several years, but we decided we just aren't that crazy about them. Oh, beans, drying beans. We grow true red cranberry bean and the papa de rolo, which is the Portuguese dove breast bean. And we dry those, and we harvest about a gallon and a half of dried beans of each type every year, and that's enough dried beans for the whole winter. We grow peas, and we also dry those, and we harvest enough dried peas for the winter. As far as fruits are concerned, we grow raspberries, and we can those. We have about 8 or 9 acres of blueberry fields, so we put up 150 pounds of blueberries. We make blueberry syrup. We make blueberry jam. We freeze it and use it in cereals and muffins and pancakes and so on and so forth. Lee's an avid and excellent baker. We grow and so blueberries, apples. We have, as I said, 350 wild apple trees, some of which the Howards planted. And I've grafted 65 heirloom apple varieties onto wild apple tree stock. And five of those last year actually bore heirloom fruit. So I've grafted onto some of them. I've done doubles or triples, the ones we're really crazy about. So I have about 85 wild apple trees that are now grafted onto heirloom varieties. And these are fantastic apples.
Is Wolf River one of them by any chance?
It is not, actually. A friend of mine down the way grows Wolf River. It doesn't keep long enough.
Okay.
The apples that I've chosen to graft are apples that have excellent flavor and long-term keeping ability. As far as apples are concerned, we put up about 60 quarts of applesauce. We dry apples, and we also keep apples in the basement. Five or six bushels of apples. And we can keep apples fresh right now until the end of March, early April, maybe beyond, a little bit beyond. But with these new varieties that are particularly excellent for long keeping, we should be able to keep fresh apples until June or July. So there's the apples. And then peaches, we have one peach tree that does well, generally fairly well. And then we have about 14 pear trees. And pears are a major food for us, too. We put up pear sauce, about 40, 50 quarts of pear sauce. Also, we can whole pears. And then when they're coming in September and October, we just eat an incredible number of pears on a daily basis. We love those pears.
Well, you know, looking at you, John, this is John Toomey with me telling us about his farming experiences. He's a very fit-looking 6'2". I guess three,
not quite that tall,
but he's very fit looking and he's got a ruddy complexion from all his outdoor activities. And he grows a marvelous amount of food. Do you grow more than you can consume?
I would say yes, we do. And we always have preserved more than we could possibly need for a given winter. We have three cupboards in the cellar. And each one of those, the total number of quarts of food that we start off the fall with are, 486 quarts of preserved vegetables and fruits. And that's a half a ton. Each quart weighs 2 pounds, so it's roughly one half ton of fruits and vegetables just in our cupboards. Then beyond that, we have 30 to 40 pounds of carrots, 30 to 40 pounds of beets, parsnip, and turnip in our root cellar. And then we have frozen vegetables as well as the dried ones. And so we inevitably have far more than we need. Now, one could ask, what do you do with any excess that you have? And that's a good question. And again, I come back to that concept of not removing any organic matter from the farm. So there will inevitably be maybe 8 or 10 butternut squash, maybe more this year, since we have such a fantastic crop of them. And those will get mulched right back into the garden. We'll just take any produce that we don't eat right back out to the garden, and it goes right back into the soil. And we have thousands of worms and night crawlers right under that mulch that are just waiting for more food to come. And they will chew that up, and it will come out as worm castings and enrich the soil. Indeed, in terms of gardening, I've never used a rototiller on the soil at all. I simply I add mulch to it constantly. I never turn the soil over. I never rototiller. I have no rototiller on my tractor or anything else. And the worms underneath the mulch simply aerate the soil, and they turn over the soil, and it keeps a nice distribution of bacteria and fungus and so on. And the plants seem to absolutely love it. If I could show you photos of my rhubarb or potatoes or my bean towers, you as a person who's had some experience gardening, you would look at those and say, my word, that soil must be absolutely teeming with nutrients. And indeed, I believe it is. We make every effort to bring as many nutrients to the garden as we can. We use wood chips from the land. We use hay from the land. We use grass that we use for chicken litter. We put all the chicken litter and chicken manure on the garden. All of the ashes from the 5 cords of firewood that we burn also go into the garden. And then any seaweed that I'm able to get at the shore or any shells that I'm able to get at the shore, I add those to the garden as well. So we always say it's impossible for a vegetable or a fruit to have in it nutrients that aren't available to it in the land. So job one for us is making absolutely certain that our fruit trees, our berries, and particularly our garden have access to a wonderful array of nutrients. And I should hasten to add that I feel exactly the same way about the whole farm. Consequently, I remove no organic matter from it because I know full well that as hay lays in the fields or brush or treetops lay in the woods, they will enrich the soil there, and that will be beneficial to the wild creatures that are, quite frankly, very near and dear to our hearts.
Well, we haven't used the word organic gardening, but I'm thinking that that's what you're doing. It's
totally. I've never used a pesticide, herbicide, or commercial fertilizer on the property anywhere ever.
Do you see pests? Do you have pests bothering?
We do. Yes, we do. I detail, there's a whole section in the gardening section in the book on pests, and we have techniques for dealing with every single one of them. Potato beetles, we hand pick. Voles, we build little fences around the things that they want to get, the carrots and the beets. Deer, we fence in the things that they want. We put on the outside of the fence the produce that they aren't so fond of. I detail every single one of those pests in the book and exactly what we do to deal with it. There are some things that bother a little bit. Slugs can be a little bit of an issue. There is an organic product, Sluggo, that we use occasionally when we get a run of slugs, but in general, we don't have to use much of that.
Do you have a farm pond?
Yes, we. I had 2 farms put in back in 83, I think it was, or 82.
2 ponds?
2 ponds, yes. Yeah. One's larger than the other. A gentleman by the name of Brub Lucas, a wonderful old-timer from Searsmont, put those in. His son is actually the road commissioner in Montville right now, Steve Lucas. But anyway, the ponds are wonderful. I like a nice, neat, and orderly pond, so I weed whack and maintain the edges very, very meticulously, in all honesty.
Do you grow food in the ponds?
Absolutely, yes. We swim in the ponds regularly, but in addition to that, every September I put in 85 brook trout into the upper pond and 45 into the lower. I put those numbers in because I don't want to provide them any commercial feed. And the ponds are large enough to support with wild feed 85 brook trout in the upper pond and 45 in the lower pond. So they will acclimate quite quickly to the ponds, and they begin to feed readily. Mid to late October, they're already rising and eating insects and so on. Then they winter over in the ponds, and as soon as the ice is out, they come right up and begin to feed again as the insect activity increases. Many times, Lee and I will sit on the porch and look down over the lower pond, and I'm not exaggerating one bit. When in late May, every minute you'll see 30 to 50 trout jump right out of the water, catching insects. It's like a little dolphin show. It's quite a delightful thing to see.
The insects what you call wild feed?
That's
the wild feed.
Yes, they eat all the insects. They eat the newts. They eat the snails. They eat everything that shows up in those ponds. And then come early June, when they're still feeding heavily, because trout will bite well at a certain times of the year under certain circumstances. So our aim is ultimately to eat those trout. So in early June, we start to fish, and we go out regularly every day and catch 15, 20, clean them, and freeze them immediately. Within a half an hour of being caught, they're right in the freezer and frozen. And Undoubtedly, I have in the freezer right now 110 frozen brook trout.
And all of this information you're sharing is in the book that you
published.
When did you publish the book?
April of 2016, coming up almost to a year now.
Okay, so it's a new book.
Yes, it is.
And how can our listeners get a copy?
Well, let's see.
Amazon or
Amazon? It's on Amazon, or you can go to johntwomey.com.
Okay.
And there's my whole web page is right there, and it can be ordered right off that web page.
Well, that's wonderful.
I'm
gonna get me one.
it's great fun, and the nice thing about it is that there's a good deal of physical activity and a good deal of work, but in all honesty, fun is a tremendously fun experience for me, and thank goodness it is for Lee as well, because as you know as well as I do. That if it's fun for one person and not fun for another, things may not be as fun as one might anticipate.
Uh-huh.
Fortunately, that is the case.
What
for
is
us.
That old saying? If Mama ain't happy, nobody's happy.
Bingo.
This is George Frangoulis with the Farmstead Radio Show on WBFY 100.9 FM in Belfast, Maine. We're learning a tremendous amount of information about living a self-sufficient life on a farm in Montville, Maine, from John Toomey, who's been doing it now for 8 years. He's told us about growing fruits and vegetables, about enjoying wildlife, enjoying the seasons, and about raising brook trout, I think it is, in
yes.
two ponds that he's had constructed on his property. And also how to get his book where you can learn all about this. Tell me about your home, your house, your shelter. You said that you heat it with 5 cords of wood. I know when I had a farmhouse and I was heating with wood, it took a lot more than five cords for me.
Well, you know, I was talking with the grandchildren of Lauren Howard, Lauren and Gertie Howard, and they said that they would burn 11 to 13 cord.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that was the case.
Yeah.
We do have a propane-fired furnace in the house and 4 different heating zones that we can fine-tune the heating from radiator hot water radiators. But our main source is the wood heat. Now, it could be the coldest day of the year. Let's say a high of 0 in the day with a good stiff breeze outside. And if I light the parlor stove, which I only light about 8 or 10 times a year, and we always run the kitchen stove, and those 2 stoves will heat the whole house. And that's it's completely because of the work that Jay Fisher and Coal Mountain Builders did on the property. They replaced the windows, they redid the insulation, and really shored the property up, the whole building up in a fashion that made it very, very tight and very energy efficient. So the 5 cords of wood do it, and I'm happy that it is only 5 cords of wood, because I cut all of the wood in November and December. Spend pretty much 5 or 6 weeks. I'm not a fast woodcutter, obviously, and we stack it up in the fields and in the woods, and we then always have 2 years supply, 2 years ahead. So we're always burning 2-year-old wood, and we bring all that in, stack it up, and it works out just fine. So with the new windows and with the good insulation, the house is really tight and really, really comfortable. Mm-hmm. We thank Jay on a daily basis or on a regular basis throughout the course of the winter.
Now, what about solar? Do you have any solar energy?
Yeah, all of the electricity in the whole farm runs off the solar panels. We have 2 24 panels, and a company called Penobscot Solar. Daryl DeJoy is the owner of that over mm-hmm. in Blue Hill, I think.
Daryl
DeJoy.
Yeah, brother.
Yeah, his brother, mm-hmm. yes, is right here.
Yeah.
Yeah, a wonderful guy, wonderful company, an expert on installing solar completely off the grid. A lot of companies handle solar that's connected to the grid superbly. But in Daryl's company, everybody who works for the company lives off-grid. So they really know off-grid living. And it's a different animal to a degree from being connected to the mm-hmm. grid. So we have the 24 panels, and they were put in 8 years ago, and six 300-pound batteries in the cellar to store energy for days when it's cloudy. We also have a large generator that we need to run, quite frankly, rarely. There can be a series of three or four cloudy days in November and December when the days are really short. And on those days, I might run the generator for an hour, hour and a half to top up the batteries. But aside from that, in all honesty, living with that solar array is, we literally never think of it. It's just like living as if you were connected to the grid. You do have to be a little bit alert, a little bit careful, but what's wrong with that? We all should be more alert, more sure. careful. and so when I say careful and alert, if it's a cloudy stretch, we'll hold off running the washing machine. Or a cloudy stretch, we'll hold off running the vacuum. But aside from that, we just go right along. We have all lights that require low power. We have a gas stove to cook on. And beyond that, everything works fantastically. We have an artesian well with pump and so on and so forth. So the whole house functions, quite frankly, better than any house that's connected to the grid that I've ever lived in. And it's far more energy efficient as well.
Oh, that's a dream we all wish we could live, I tell you. That's wonderful. You mentioned a word, and I wanted to pick up on the word. You said it's a different animal. I want to talk about animals on your farm.
Mm-hmm.
You told me you have chickens. Tell us about your chickens.
Okay, yes. I've had chickens since I was a little child. I think I'd have a hard time living without chickens. So right now, we for the last 8 years, we've had, even before that, down in Mass, I was raising a breed called the Golden Campines. And the Golden Campine.
Can you spell that for us?
GoldenCampine. And they're featured in the book as well, photos, as well as a good description of their attributes. And their attributes include the fact that they're about three-quarters the size of a regular hen or a regular chicken, so they eat about three-quarters as much. They forage exceptionally well. They really, really go after the greens and the insects in the wild, and they were out foraging today. They'll forage whenever there's not snow on the ground. They're very, very sturdy birds, and I'll give you a little bit on their history in a moment. So they forage very well. They also fly well, so they're able to evade predators. In the last 8 years, we've only lost one bird to a hawk. And then beyond that, their coloration, brown and gold, makes them relatively difficult for most predators to see. Now, as far as their history is concerned, they're a very unique breed in that they were developed in the Campine, C-A-M-P-I-N-E, region of Belgium about 2,000 years ago. In fact, it's said that when Julius Caesar entered that part of what is today Belgium, he encountered these birds, and he was so struck by them that he had his cohorts gather together several flocks of them to bring them back to Rome. So they're strikingly beautiful. Now, the feature about this area of Campine is that it has harsh climate, and the soil isn't particularly rich. So they needed a bird there that was very self-sufficient, very able to defend itself, and very able to get by on reasonably lean rations. So I thought to myself, this is the bird that should be ideal for Maine. And it turns out that really they have been. I've given chicks to a number of people, and they're quite thrilled with them. In fact, Meadowmack High School in Waldorf, that has an heirloom seed project, it's a pretty widespread and well-known project, they're developing three breeds of heirloom chickens to foster in this area. They contacted me last year about fostering the Golden Campine, so we hatched a couple dozen young for them and took them down there, and they're raising them now, and they're going to sell the chicks to whoever's interested in them. So that's the Meadowmack High School down in Waldorf.
Where else could we get chicks?
Well, there's a hatchery out in Iowa called Murray McMurray. They have them, and I've gotten them from Murray McMurray, and they were good birds, but I've gotten better ones from, I think, a company called Ideal Poultry in Waco, Texas. Mm-hmm. They had, among the finest line of Golden Campines that I've ever seen, not that I'm an expert in that area. But their birds are sturdy, they're beautiful, and they were very efficient on shipping them to me when I got them. I got some new blood from them about 4 years ago. I was very pleased with those birds.
Well, when somebody buys chickens by mail order, what do they get in the mail?
Let's say they're coming from Texas. They hatch today. They put them immediately into a box, large enough number of chicks so that they'll stay warm. And a chick, when it hatches, it seals within its abdomen the yolk from the egg. So they're able to go for 48 hours without eating or drinking. So they FedEx them right up to you, or UPS them right up to you, or overnight them right up to you. And you just pick them up the next day, and there you have it. They're lovely little chicks, just sprightly and going about their way.
And then what do you do?
Well, we bring them in the house then, and we have a large wooden box, and we have a light set up in that. And we brood them until they're about 2 or 3 weeks old, until they're feathered out pretty well. We never get chicks or hatch them. We have an incubator ourselves. Lee's an expert at hatching chicks. She used to do this in her classroom all the time. We never get chicks or hatch chicks before the end of May. So that by week 3, when they're feathering out pretty well in the brood box, it's warm enough out so that they can go out into the exterior pen. We have 2 pens outside in the barn. All the chickens are kept in the barn, so they're easy to tend in the winter and easy to tend in the summer. So we have 1 pen for the adults and another pen for the youngsters. We don't put the youngsters with the adults until they're large enough, because they'll fight. They'll pick on them. So we move them out there, and then we slowly introduce them into the flock. And before you know it, they're happy campers, just like the rest of the golden campaigns.
Well, I think anybody on your farm is a happy camper.
they seem to be, and while we work to make them happy and the wild creatures happy, they also contribute hugely to our happiness.
Do you have any pets or companion animals on your farm?
No, we don't.
You don't? Okay.
No,
I didn't think you probably did.
Yeah, no, we don't keep cats and no dogs either. Yeah.
Okay. Now, what about, have you found and nurtured any baby wildlife that were orphaned ever?
No, we haven't. We occasionally will run upon a young wild animal, let's say a fawn or a snowshoe hare or a robin just out of the nest. And we're pretty aware of the fact that what looks like an orphaned animal often is not.
Okay.
Or an orphaned bird often is not. When the youngsters are just fledging or coming out of the nest or getting going, they're often left by the mother for a decent amount of time. And in the case of hare and deer, they leave them all day, and they come back and feed them in the evening. And a baby bird, a bluebird or a swallow or a robin or whatever it happens to be, the mother and father will know where that baby is, and they'll be bringing it food until it could fly along pretty well. So we just kind of, if we see something like that, we'll observe it, just keep right on moving and not bother the parent.
So your advice is just leave it where it is, in the woods or wherever, in the field.
Yeah. Absolutely. I had a lovely experience a couple summers ago. There was a fawn that was bedding during the day, maybe 50 yards above the garden, right in the field in front of the house. And at dusk, the doe would come into the corner of that field. And the fawn, you wouldn't see it all day long. Occasionally, you might see it stand up and stretch. But the doe would come into the corner of that field, and she'd have her head up high. She was looking, and she would make a little sound. And as soon as she made that sound, that little fawn would leap up and race to her, and then nurse immediately. And it was a joyous experience. It was clear to me that they had feelings. The doe was thrilled to see that little fawn, and that fawn was absolutely ecstatic to see its mother. And then off they trotted, and she would move around in the evening, and the little guy would follow her around, learn what to eat and who was safe to be near, and so on and so forth. So that whole process of watching, nurturing, and nurturing the land so that they can nurture one another, to me, is hugely satisfying.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about the pond, I did have a question that I'd forgotten to ask you. Do you have frogs in your ponds?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we have all kinds of frogs. We have, and they're a huge joy. In the spring, right off, we start with the call of the wood frog, the one that sort of quack, 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 quack. And then come the spring peepers, Then come the tree frogs, the great tree frog, that trill sound. And then the American toads come and mate in early June, and then in come the big bullfrogs. So we have all of those frogs, and we just love listening to those frog calls. And so they're an integral part of the pond life. Now, I didn't bring any frogs in there. After the ponds were built, it was amazing to see a whole freshwater ecosystem just developed right there. Frogs came, snails came, newts came, salamanders came. And in late April, inevitably on what's called the big night, when it's warm and rainy and the amphibians move, we'll go out with a flashlight and sometimes we'll see 100 to 150 toads and frogs and salamanders working their way down to the ponds. And one night, I think it was a year ago or so, we went down to the pond with a light, and the yellow-spotted salamander and the blue-spotted salamander spend about 95 or 96% of their life underground. They're mole salamanders. But at this time of year and that big day in April, they come out, and they mate in those ponds. And, you know, it's rare to come upon a yellow-spotted salamander. You may have seen one or two in your life. I can remember the very first one I saw in Roxbury, Connecticut, next to my grandmother's step on her farm. I was probably 2 years old, and I can remember it as if it were yesterday. But coming back to that big night.
What do you mean, the big night?
The big night means the night when all the amphibians move to the water to mate and lay eggs, the big night. And it's a night when we really, if we find a warm, rainy night in late April, we ought to try to curtail our driving or be very careful, because they are on the move at that mm-hmm. night. Now, one night we counted 30 to 40 yellow-spotted salamanders swimming around our lower pond, and they look like little alligators, just searching for one another. Spectacular scene. Mm-hmm. Very heartwarming.
Have you observed on your farm over the years any diminution or decrease in any of the wildlife because of climate change?
I can honestly say that I have not so far. Not that I'm certainly no expert in climate change, but in terms of watching the numbers of creatures that I see, I'm seeing about the same. I would say I'm not noting any difference. Now, that could have to do also with the improvement of the habitat. Mm-hmm. Since we're constantly working to make an abundance of the trees and the brush and the grasses and the flowers that the wild creatures like, I think there's the potential for an increase in the numbers simply because mm-hmm. there is more place to nest and there are more things to eat. And wild pollinators are a big item on my agenda, too. I could tell you a little bit about that if you're interested.
Beyond the bee, beyond the honeybee, what pollinators are you talking about?
Yeah, we don't keep any honeybees. We foster native bumblebees and all of the mason bees, the blue orchard bee and the leafcutter bee. These are fantastic pollinators for all of our plants, the blueberries and the apples as well. And it's noteworthy that they are 10 times more efficient at pollinating than are the European honeybees. Beyond that, they'll work below 55 degrees when the European honeybees really don't like to work, and they'll also work in the rain and in the drizzle, conditions that the European honeybees don't like to work in. So we get a lot of cool temperatures in the early spring, so these wild pollinators are absolutely critical in terms of pollinating our blueberries and our apples, and this is true across the land. So I do several things for them. I maintain several miles of stone walls, and I keep them open so the bees can find places to nest. The bumblebees can find places to nest. I build brush piles that the bumblebees nest in. Now, other wildlife benefit by the brush piles as well. I girdle trees in certain locations to kill them so that borers will get in there and create holes that the mason bees can then lay their eggs in. And beyond that, then, I maintain also in the fields, I always maintain three different habitats, one of which is an area that I mow quite close. And I have growing in those 12 areas, low-mowed areas, dandelion in the early spring, three different kinds of clovers, alsike, purple top and ladino clover, and sow thistle for a fall flowering for the wild bees. Beyond that, I have all sorts of flowers in the fields per se. So I'm doing everything I can to create housing and food supply for these native pollinators, many of which are endangered or suffering right now. So they're really a critical thing, and the more any of us can do for them, the better.
Okay. What about snakes?
Snakes? Oh, yeah, we love them.
What do you see? What kinds?
We see – now, that's one that that has diminished. I'll get to that in just a second. We see the garter snake, the yellow and black striped one. We see the little red-bellied snake, about 12 inches long. That one's quite common. I've seen a milk snake – only a couple, though. Mm-hmm. Back in the late 70s, I did see the grass snake or the green snake, which I think is probably the most beautiful snake in the world. Mm-hmm. Has green eyes and green everywhere. The belly's a little yellow. And I haven't seen one of those in quite a few years. If anything, that would be one indicator of a drop. Aside from that, I don't see any drop in wildlife so far.
We're getting close to end of our time. We have a few more minutes to go, and I'm having a great time listening to John Toomey tell us about farm life in Montville, Maine. He's been practicing agriculture and wildlife management on his own terms, in his own terms. How many acres do you have, John?
125 acres, yeah. And if I could add, I'm such a fan of wildlife and wild things. They were so important to me in my childhood, and they're so important to me now. And I work hard to give back to them. And I've never met a person, be it a hunter or a fisher, a fisherman, fisherwoman, or a person who's vegan who doesn't love seeing wildlife. Mm-hmm. And they're near and dear to everyone's heart. And even the most avid hunter I've met, and I've known a number, they'll always say, I'm more thrilled to see something than I am to actually find something and get it hunting. They're all moved by that. And I would just say that it doesn't matter who you are or where you are. If you have a small backyard or a large plot of land, you could do a variety of things to foster or make the habitat more appealing to wildlife. And it doesn't need to be a large project, a very small project. The important thing is to do a little something. And if we all do a little something, the wild creatures that we all so enjoy would, I think, be far better off than they are now.
Excellent. Excellent, John. Well, I want to thank Lee. I haven't met Lee. Mm-hmm. She's holding down the fort, she let you out tonight to Belfast.
Yeah,
and we appreciate that, Lee. Thank you so much. Hope to see you sometime.
Yeah, she's listening now, I'm sure.
You said she was going to take notes and tell you what you you messed up, huh?
That's right. Strengths and weaknesses.
Well, this has been wonderful, John. I really have appreciated
it. I've enjoyed it, George.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Is there any last thing you want to tell us or say?
Not really. I mean, I would say the lifestyle has been entirely satisfying and a joy. We eat all sorts of wonderful stuff and enjoy seeing all kinds of wild creatures on a daily basis. And for us, it's maybe not the lifestyle for everyone, but for us, it's very much our cup of tea.
Well, I had one last question. And it was, what do you do for fun? But I think you've spent an hour telling us what you do for fun.
It actually is. Every day is quite a joy.
All right. Thank you, John Toomey.
Thank you very much. Appreciate
this is George Frangoulis for the Farmstead Radio Show, WBFY 100.9 FM.